Hi, I'm Stuart Spinks and welcome to episode 297 of my podcast, Beekeeping Short and Sweet. This week, I'm joined by Nick Bunker, a relative newcomer to beekeeping and a volunteer who offered himself up to have a conversation about how his beekeeping has been progressing and hopefully get some reasonable answers to any questions he might have. Beekeeping Short and Sweet, a beekeeping podcast for the inquisitive beekeeper with a short attention span. A beekeeper, in fact, just like me. Today's podcast is sponsored in part by Healthy Bees, Heavy Hives, a new book on beekeeping today with a focus on helping you maximise your yields and, hopefully, increasing profitability in beekeeping. Featuring clear diagrams and beautiful photographs that complement a relaxed and humorous writing style, which is both enjoyable and informative to read. Available now at Northern Bee Books, Amazon, and all good bookstores, both online and in your high street. You'll find links in today's podcast notes. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. And today I'm joined by Nick Bunker, who is from Lincolnshire and has been keeping bees for just a short few years, really. And this has come about as a result of me, I think, and Nick will correct me, but I think in one of my podcasts, I suggested that I might see if we could get a beginner beekeeper on to have a chat about all things beginner beekeeperish. And Nick very kindly sent me an email and volunteered. So Nick, thank you for volunteering. Thanks for coming on the podcast. You're very welcome.
No, thanks very much for having me. I'm truly honoured to be here.
Let's get straight into the beekeeping. And for all of you listening, Nick sent me a CV, a beekeeping CV. I did actually ask him for some questions and got some very thorough notes, which I think highlights some of the pitfalls, I guess, of beginner beekeeping and some of the things that can happen when you get involved in beekeeping and fall in love with it, which I think is probably what's happened here. So, Nick, I'm going to stop talking. Tell me where you're from and how you got involved in beekeeping.
Yeah, so I'm from just outside of Louth in Lincolnshire. So sort of very much an East Coast market town. And ever since being young, sort of 13, 14, I've always worked outside in agriculture. And that's all I ever wanted to do. I was lucky enough to be offered positions working outside and worked on various farms for 8 or 9 years before I left and went into a different industry. I'm quite lucky in that I have the opportunity to retire when I get to 50. And a couple of years ago, I was just casually mentioning to a friend of mine that I fancy keeping some bees. And as it happens, he knew somebody who kept bees. And literally within a week, I'd got a phone call from somebody saying, "Oh, here, you want to keep some bees?" And that's really how I got into it. So it was, I think it was the 26th of March, 2021, that I got into it and started off with just one hive that are sort of local mongrel type bees that he caught from swarm the year before. And it's gone from there, really.
And what type of hive are you using?
Yeah, I'm currently using wooden nationals.
Okay.
Currently using just national deeps. I don't actually have many national shallows, so I collect honey in the deeps. And the idea behind that was I thought I'd give it a go, really, in that one size of frame. And then obviously I've only got one size of frame to worry about. And I'm okay with lifting at the moment. And I thought, well, at the end of the day, if it doesn't work out, I've not lost anything because I still need brood boxes.
And one of the benefits of using brood boxes is that you will get an awful lot of comb drawn and you can use that in the actual brood box. So what Nick is explaining here is that he's using a national brood box as a super as well. I'm understanding that right, yes, Nick?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So in doing that, you are going to give yourself a bad back and possibly a hernia, but the positive side of that is that you're only using, as Nick says, one size of frame. And when you find that you need to get into the brood box to maybe replace some of the old brood comb, you've already got drawn frames there. And when beekeepers first start beekeeping, drawn comb is like the holy grail. If you can get your bees to draw comb from foundation, it really does give you a head start. So you started with one colony, and how did your first year go with that one colony?
Yeah, it was an interesting first year. And the guy that I started off with, he lives about 40, 50 minutes from me. I live in a rural Lincolnshire area, and we've got a lot of rape around here. And what I found was that my first colony of bees didn't really know what I was doing particularly with them. He was quite some distance away, so he was on the end of the telephone. But you know, I didn't really have any assistance in anybody coming looking at them with me, so I didn't really know what to look at. Anyway, it got to the time of year on your Facebook channel where people said, "Oh, you know, maybe you ought to be harvesting the honey." What happened was I took the honey off mine, and I think it was only one super I took off them, and I was a proud one myself, and I'd arranged to go and see him, and he was going to extract the honey for me. And I put it on the cold floor in the utility room.
Okay.
Left it there for 2 days, and you can guess what happened. When I took it to my friend in near Scunthorpe, he had all crystallised. Yeah. I got hardly anything from them. So.
Yeah, and honestly, once it starts to granulate in the comb, there's really not much you can do with it. You just have to cut it out and melt it down and separate the wax from the honey that way. You just cannot extract using a normal extractor, using a radial extractor, tangential extractor. It just won't come out, however you try to get it out. Did you get much of a crop that first year?
No, literally, I don't know, maybe £10 at most. And that's probably generous, to be perfectly honest. So it was pretty much a failure. And not only that, I'd taken some photos of the frames. And when I showed them to my friend, he said, "I don't know what's wrong." He said, "But that's not right." So I had to find the queen, which I had to kill, and then put in a new queen. And to be fair, you know, once I've done that, although it was too late in the season to get anything from them, the colony did actually go from strength to strength.
And what time of the year did you introduce that new queen?
Well, probably extracted in maybe May, so probably June, July-ish, I would say. I can't just remember off the top of my head.
Okay, no, that's fine. We've introduced queens into colonies in certainly early June, and they've done very well, particularly those that we've been buying in from Luke and Susie at Northumberland Honey. But you are then very much running against the clock when the season is kind of at its peak and you're trying to get bees to do perhaps a bit too much. And I think that's a mistake that we all make when we first start beekeeping, trying to just get the bees to pull lots of comb. Presumably at this point you were on foundation in those frames?
No, I'd actually bought the colony, you know, as a full-size colony with drawn foundation in it. So it had drawn comb to use. The only thing I would say is that although I didn't, you know, I took a very small amount of honey off them, actually when it came to the next year and the first time I went in them, there was honey absolutely everywhere. And I thought to myself, you know, how's this happened? Because obviously it was winter, they're not really eating very much. Yeah, I'd been giving them fondant as well, and I thought maybe they'd stored some of the fondant. I don't know. But actually, yeah, there was a lot of honey that following spring when I opened it up.
Okay. You finished your first year with just the one colony?
I think I'd also caught a swarm as well, a local swarm. But I'd just seen somebody on Facebook put something about there being a swarm. It was quite late on in the year, I believe, that I got it, maybe August. And I put that into a polynuke, and well, that's part of second year really, in that it did absolutely nothing whatsoever, to be perfectly honest. I don't know whether that's something that I did wrong or whether that's something to do with the genetics of that particular queen, because it just did not build up like the other colonies I got whatsoever.
One of the challenges with late swarms and anything July onwards really tends to be a real battle to try and get them to a size large enough to overwinter, and you can find yourself spending an awful lot of time nursing a very poor colony through the autumn and into the winter, treating them, feeding them, spending lots of time on them, and then actually not much happens with them at all. And sometimes those late swarms are best left alone rather than chasing after them. And certainly this is something I did when I first started. If there was a swarm, I was going to get it because I wanted to have more bees and I wanted to fill more boxes with more bees. And it can become a bit of an addiction, collecting swarms. So I'm sure that there are people out there who just love collecting swarms for collecting swarms' sake. It's just one of those things. It is remarkable watching a swarm get shaken into, let's say, a skep or a cardboard box, and then have them all settle into that skep, and you pick it up, take it away, put it into a hive, and it develops into a full-size colony. That's fantastic, particularly if you can do it in the spring at the beginning of the season with those first primary swarms that come out. Anything late in the year is always going to be hard work. So you took some bees through that first year into the second year. I guess they must have survived the winter, and you came out with a reasonable number of bees in the spring.
I certainly came through the winter with at least three, if not five, that first year. Because got the original hive. My friend had also, as part of the sort of the deal we struck, he'd given me an empty hive, and I think I've got some bees from somewhere for those as well. And then I think I also bought another queen, did a split, put them into a second polynuc. So I've got a few hives, and actually all of them came through winter. I didn't lose anything, and it's only actually this last year that I've lost a queen or a colony through the winter, which is just a queen that's unfortunately died.
Going into your second year, what would you say you learn in that first year? It sounds very much as if you were on your own for most of the year without too much help in your own apiary.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everything I've learned from books, watching your videos, YouTube videos, your Patreon videos that you put out. Also, obviously, the Facebook groups, because there's actually loads and loads of knowledge on there. I think the thing for me is actually picking through it, because it's that age-old thing, isn't it? You ask five beekeepers, you get 10 different answers. So it's understanding what's right for you. I found that's quite difficult. I've listened to some things, and they've said, for instance, about not feeding during the summer. Well, personally, I from a very, very, very beginner standpoint, I don't think that works for me. I think for me, it's not a blanket you don't feed. I think you've got to assess the situation, because, like I said, I live in a very monocrop area, and actually, although I'm basing it on not a lot of experience, what I found is that so far I get a really good spring crop, and then actually the autumn and the summer and autumn isn't as good, because it's almost boom or bust.
I mean, you've hit on a really important point there. Listening to other beekeepers giving you advice, it can be incredibly helpful, but it can also be incredibly dangerous. And you've done exactly the right thing, which is to assess your local situation, determine what you've got in terms of forage. And as you say, if you feel you need to feed because there isn't the availability of pollen and nectar for your bees, then you have to feed. Otherwise, if you're taking a crop, your bees are likely to starve in the summer. So, yeah, hats off to you. You've already cleared the first hurdle, which is to listen to what everybody has to say, but then have a little think about what's happening with your bees and your own personal situation, and adjust what you're hearing to exactly what you've got in front of you. What advice would you give to anyone starting beekeeping for the first time this year, having the experience of your first year? Is there anything, any one thing, let's say, that springs to mind that you would suggest to a new beekeeper?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not I'm very inexperienced, and I do appreciate that. But I think with inexperience also comes the hindsight, maybe, in thinking, do you know what, maybe actually I needed somebody just to come, even if it was just once a month, and just say, actually, Nick, what do you think about that in the hive? Do you think that's right? Somebody who's just got that bit of experience that you do trust, and somebody who's maybe looking to try and do the same things as you. Because had that have happened in my first year, well, certainly I hope I'd have had some honey from the colony that I had. And also maybe they'd have identified a bit sooner the problems that I've got with that particular queen. And then obviously going into year two, I made some splits, and I remember going into making a split, and I think I put a queen cell with it. And I'd got some little nuc boxes that I'd made myself out of some marine ply. And I gave them, I filled the feeder up with syrup, and with it only being a nuc, obviously it only took a litre of syrup. Well, I then went on a holiday for a week, certainly 3 or 4 days, come back no bees. Unfortunately, they're starved. You know, so there's some very, very simple things that actually, had I had somebody who was willing just to spend that little bit of time, or, you know, had I perhaps put myself out there a bit more and actually asked for that, then I think that would have definitely helped me in my first year and year two.
Okay. And it's a really good point. If you can find a local, not necessarily a mentor, you don't really need to commit to that beginner mentor relationship. But if you're a certainly if you're a member of a local beekeeping association, then there will be more experienced beekeepers within that association that you can talk to. And, you know, I'll say it myself, it's great having videos that you can watch, and it's great having podcasts that you can listen to, but nothing really replaces having somebody stood beside you at the beehive, looking over your shoulder at the bees that you're inspecting, and just pointing out one or two little things that you might miss that can make all of the difference. So if you can get a mentor or an assistant to help a more experienced beekeeper just to pop around and have a look every now and again, then it can really help your beekeeping. So looking at year two, and I've got your notes that you sent me, Nick, there's a paragraph that says you've gone from 5 to around 25 hives or nukes. Does that sound right?
That's entirely right. So obviously from the winter of year one, I had gone to 5. And like I say, they were, I think there was a couple of bought in queens there, and the rest were local bees that I've found and, you know, got from swarms and such like. And then, yeah, last year I sort of had a bit of an epiphany, really, in that, you know, I've got potentially, like I said, 5 years until I'm looking to do something very different with my career. And, you know, I have another very, very small little business that I try and keep running, but it's all the time during the winter. So actually, I thought, do you know what? This actually works really well, because you tend to be really busy with your bees during the summer, well, spring and summer. My other little business runs sort of autumn, winter. My wife's an aromatherapist, so she uses some of the products. And we've both got a real interest in the outside. So I thought, actually, there's maybe actually a chance of being able to do something as a bit of a sideline. Don't get me wrong, I'm not looking to take over the world, but it's something that I really enjoy. And what I do want to do when I get to 50 is to actually enjoy something, to go to work wanting to do what I'm doing. And whether that's my other little business or whether it's this, I know that I will be doing that. I will be going to work wanting to go and, you know, wanting to, you know, make a bit of a difference really in my own business, because I've spent all my life working for other people. And it's always been a dream really to have my own business and be my own boss. So this is an ideal opportunity, especially given that I know people around this area who are farmers, and that they will let me have out apiaries. And so that's sort of how I came to that massive growth, really.
Okay.
In 5 to 25 in year two.
And can we talk about how you made those splits? What techniques did you use in order to get from 5 to 25?
Yeah, so a lot of it I did myself with my own queen cells from my own hive. I had one particular hive which was probably my best hive, and they started throwing up some queen cells. So I took the queen out, walkway split, and then I was taking frames with the queen cells out and putting them into a nuke box, putting some bees in, putting some food in, and taking them to an out apiary 3 miles away. So that was how I did a lot of that. And then I also actually bought some queens as well. I bought them from quite a few suppliers, to be fair. What I would say is, though, I'm not entirely certain for somebody like me that is sustainable, because you've got to be good at it, because they're quite expensive. So if you're not good at it, it gets even more expensive. So yeah, that's one thing I'd say. I have lost a few queens that I've bought in, and it's really quite devastating, really. If you've spent £50, you know, well, you don't want to lose the bees anyway, but then you've also spent £50 on a queen. And she's there, she's introduced, and then maybe you go a week later, she's still there. And then a couple of weeks after that, all of a sudden there's a supersedure cell and she's gone.
That's not unusual, to be fair, Nick. It is devastating, and it does hurt the bank balance. It happens to us on a regular basis. We'll probably buy in queens again this year. In fact, there's no probably about it. We are buying queens in again this year. And I can guarantee that there will be it's only a small percentage, but there is a percentage that will go exactly that way. where you think everything's okay, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, the queen has disappeared and there's a supersedure cell. So you're not alone in that, and you can have all the years of experience in beekeeping that you can build up in a lifetime, and it will still happen. So it's probably nothing that you're doing wrong. I'm interested to know what time of year you were doing these splits. Can you talk about the timing of it?
So I had a quick look at that actually before I spoke to you, and certainly the bought-in queens weren't actually until the middle to the end of August. And what I found is that luckily, well, other than one, which I've lost over winter this year, all of the queens are still alive. However, I found that the nukes are actually quite small in size. I mean, they certainly wouldn't, they're nothing like big enough at the moment at sort of the beginning of April to put into a full-size hive. So I think for me, and you know, I hope you'll either agree or put me right, I think I probably made the splits too late, or should I say I didn't make them strong enough at the time. And also, because I was, you know, listening to people saying you shouldn't need to feed bees during the summer, I should have probably fed them more. So they're the three sort of things that I've come to the conclusion while I've been scratching my head for the last 2 weeks after I've sort of had a quick look at them to think, you know, what's gone wrong here? It's not as I expected.
So let's just dig deep into this a little bit more, because I'm sure there are lots of people out there that have encountered exactly the same scenario. We've got colonies that have been split into nukes in August and had bought-in queens introduced into those nukes. Five-frame national nukes?
Correct, yeah.
Five-frame national nukes, okay. And were all the frames drawn comb, or did you add any foundation?
No, they'd have been all drawn comb.
Okay, so and that's the benefit of the system that you're using, and that you've got frames that get drawn in the, let's call them honey boxes, and then you can extract those and reuse those frames. But you're in an area where you've already said you don't think there's a great deal of forage for them in the summer. I guess post oilseed rape, you tend not to see a great deal. Unfortunately, I don't know the area terribly well, so I can't comment on what might or might not be available. But certainly, if you're going to make those splits, I would have wanted to feed them. If you weren't adding full frames of food, I would have wanted to have fed them and probably given them some pollen substitute or pollen that I'd collected in order to make sure they've got enough protein to feed a growing brood nest area. That pollen is really important for the developing larvae, and they need lots and lots of protein, which is the pollen. And if you haven't got many flowering plants that the bees can forage on at that time of the year, then maybe that's caused you a slight problem as well. There's absolutely no reason not to split bees in August, and we've done it incredibly badly, as I've documented quite well, because most of the nukes that we created were destroyed by wasps a couple of years ago. However, generally speaking, autumn splits are a good thing and can work really well, but you do need to make sure that they've got plenty of food going into them so that they can build up, the brood nest can grow and develop, and then they've got food stores and brood and adult bees to see them through the winter that is to come. If you don't have that, then I guess we've been lucky this year because we've had a fairly mild winter, but the bees will dwindle quite quickly as you get through into late January and February. Because if you imagine you go into the late autumn, early winter, and the bees that are emerging are your adult bees to keep that cluster as warm as possible. And the more bees you have at that point of the season, it will have an effect on the size of the brood nest that they can continue to develop into that early winter. So the more bees that you can develop at that point means that they will survive through past Christmas into the new year, and then hopefully come out at the end of February into a nice, warm, sunny March without any rain. And away you go. You can then move them into a full-size hive and build them up. So currently, those nukes that you've got, in terms of if you're looking down into the nuke box and the gaps between the frames are what I would call a seam of bees, how many seams of bees would you say you've got in between each of those nuke boxes?
Yeah, so to be fair, they vary. And I don't know whether it's something to do. The strongest one was probably made slightly earlier, and it's also in a poly nuke as opposed to a wooden nuke that I've made. And it's probably, to be fair, ready to go into a hive. The weakest one, which I saw this weekend because I just had a quick look through them, literally, it's still got the queen, but it's got a handful of bees in it. And then it ranges from in between. I would say they're probably about a couple of seams of bees, really, most of them, you know, the others that I've made.
Okay. So currently we're heading into that oilseed rape nectar flow. So we're going to get a sudden rush of nectar. I know that some people are already on a nectar flow. I've had messages and reports that some people have a nectar flow from oilseed rape already. And this is another one of those know your local conditions kind of situations, because we've got bees on oilseed rape that is just about to start delivering up some nectar. And in another apiary, the plants are barely putting on flower buds. They're really several weeks behind the crops that are the most advanced. So you have to know the local area, and you will obviously have a good idea of what's available for you. And what I would say is develop your strongest colonies. You're obviously after a honey crop this year. Develop the strongest colonies into hives and build them up with drawn comb. You're ahead of the game. Most people would move a nuke into a full-size hive with foundation. So if you've got drawn comb, then you're already one step ahead. Yeah. But if oilseed rape is the only crop that you're likely to get, then what I would suggest is that your planning needs to be for that oilseed rape crop if you're looking to produce a honey crop. You've gone through year two. We're into year three now. This is our third year for you.
So that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so we're into year three. And how do you see the beginning of this season panning out for you, and what are your plans for this year?
Well, every year I actually write down my goals and my aims. And believe it or not, actually, and I hope this is achievable, you know, all I've set myself up for is having five of those 25 colonies that will actually be producing me honey. I don't know, that's probably, well, I hope that's achievable. And I should be there, because, you know, I went at the weekend and I put some supers on five of them already, the biggest colonies. I have bought some more equipment in the Thorn sale, and I intend to grow a little bit more, but I also need to be very mindful in that I've got a family. I've also got a full-time job. So,
of course,
I don't know just how much more I can grow and be able to give everything the appropriate time. So just for me for this year, I think my biggest thing really by the time we finish the season is I really want to nail down this area and whether I am going to get an autumn crop, because if I'm not, then I just need to understand that, and I maybe need to make different plans for after the rape. I might be lucky enough to find, you know, borage or something, you know, if I ask some other beekeepers, and, you know, I might be able to move them to there. I'm a long way from any heather, so that's very unlikely, and I don't really know anybody where there would be any of that. But and I think the other main thing for me, other than nailing down the honey crop, getting honey from five colonies of bees, is actually I want to make sure that this year I go into winter with full colonies. I had this thing where I decided last year maybe it was a bit late for me, or I'd done something wrong for making the splits, and I was going to try and do it earlier this year. I might be a little bit scuppered in that I need the kit available, and the bees are probably going to be in there for, I don't know, maybe another month, 6 weeks. So then already we're sort of getting to May. So it's going to be a bit of a juggle, really, to increase an awful lot more. But I definitely want to go into winter with big booming colonies, if I possibly can, as opposed to struggling with smaller colonies through the winter.
I would suggest that in your current situation, 25 hives is quite a full-on situation to be dealing with, given the amount of experience that you've got. 25 colonies, if you look after them well and you get them ready for honey production, should easily deliver you maybe half to a full ton of honey. It's a target, 25 hives and a ton of honey is achievable. The problem that you have is this dearth of forage through the summer and into the autumn. And so your expectations on what those hives might deliver will need to be tempered, because for me to say, well, you should be able to get a ton of honey from 25 hives could mean that we get through to the autumn and you're really disappointed because you don't have that ability to take the bees elsewhere because of all the commitments that you've got. I think it's really important that over the next 4.5 years or so, before you hit that retirement opportunity, that you build the experience that you've obviously gained in these first 2 full years of beekeeping, but really dive deep into those beehives and learn as much as you can about what you're looking at. It's one of those things that I talk about regularly on my podcast, is that people will inspect their beehives, but they don't actually look at what they're seeing on the frames. Their attention is caught by the multicolored pollen or the queen laying an egg, and they then miss the obvious signs of disease, for instance. So when you take a frame out and you look at it, have in mind a reason for looking at it. Now, it might be that you're looking at the brood. It might be that the brood that you're specifically focusing on is the capped brood. And I can take a frame out of one of my hives, move the bees off the sealed brood, and spot a single cell that's got a hole in it. And that to me means I need to investigate further as to why there's a hole in that cell. A lot of beginner beekeepers will look at that frame, not move the bees, and think that everything's okay. And it's just those little things that you need to develop and gain experience in. And it will really help your beekeeping move on tremendously. Understanding what healthy brood looks like and knowing what is healthy brood is, again, really, really important. Because once you've seen healthy brood, if you have a problem, it will jump out very, very quickly. And then, you know, you don't have to do anything on the spot. You can close the hive down, go away, make that phone call, call somebody else in and get them to have a look with you. And that's the benefit of being a member of an association or having somebody locally who's willing to come and help you out. But I think fundamentally, just taking the conversation back to the number of hives you've got, I would make your focus this year very much building up the colonies that you've got into strong colonies, as you've said, and making sure that as you go through the summer, they have sufficient food, and that seems to be potentially a problem for you. Make sure they've got lots of stores and build them up nice and strongly for the autumn and winter. Again, one of the issues you will encounter if you don't have the food for them is that the queen will stop laying eggs. So she'll just slow down, and you hear people talking about at the peak of her egg laying, she'll be laying 1,500 to 2,000 eggs a day. But she'll only do that if they've got the resources coming in. And if they suddenly find the tap gets turned off and there's no more forage, then she will reduce her egg laying accordingly. And so it's important that you continue to feed them and build them up through into that autumn. I would say talk to other local beekeepers. It's something you need to find out what's happening locally to you and whether there is some other forage available, because if there is something that you can access, then it will work in a positive way on both of those scenarios. You'll potentially get a summer crop of honey, and your bees will benefit by having that natural food source, and the brood nests will continue to grow. I would just be happy with 25 colonies for a couple of years and make sure that you're happy in how you're dealing with those colonies. You get to know them and know your equipment, get into a routine of carrying out those inspections. And then once you're happy with that, you could then maybe put aside 6 to maybe 10 nukes for the winter, just for any winter losses that you might suffer. So if you've got 25 colonies,
I wouldn't want to lose more than 10%. Maybe just put half a dozen nukes aside for winter losses that you might encounter, so that when you get through to next spring, you've got replacements coming through, so you're then not battling it again. And for you, if the spring crop, the oilseed rape, is your main crop, then everything you do now needs to be leading up to that oilseed rape crop. How far off is your oilseed rape at the moment, Nick? Because, you know, we've got bees that I'm about to put extra boxes on. Have you got any oilseed rape in flower ready to deliver, or is it all still in bud?
So, yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag again. I've got apiaries on two different farmers' land at the moment. So what I would call my home apiary literally is right next to a rape field. And probably only in the last couple of days has there actually been any flowers on it at all. And even now, there's only an odd one, you know, as you cast your sort of glance across the field. So that one's very, very sort of far behind. And I don't know whether that's a type of crop or whether they planted it a bit later. Literally 3 miles up the road, my other apiary it backs on actually to a rape field. And it's probably been just starting flower for about a week now. So I think definitely behind a lot of other areas in the country. And I don't know if some of that's to do with, so the Lincolnshire Wolds, you know, if I look out of my house, literally I look straight down to the coast, which is probably 15, 20 miles, something like that. We're sort of right on the very start of the Wolds. So actually, whenever you get an east wind, it's absolutely freezing here because it comes straight off the sea. So yes, some of it could be because of that. You know, the probably like yourself, you know, Norfolk, obviously, it's quite eastal coastal, isn't it? But that also could actually be something where my bees are maybe a little bit slower to start as well because of the local conditions. And I have considered that as well when I've been sort of reading what people are saying. You know, people down south, you know, of the country, they've been saying that they've got, you know, raping flower and there's nectar coming in. And I've seen a little bit of nectar at, I had a quick look through the bees at the weekend, but, you know, definitely not any huge volumes of rape yet.
Okay. I'm sure that you must have a few hedgerows scattered about, and I'm sure that the bees will be on, I guess it's wild plum. I haven't seen any blackthorn that I have noticed in flower yet, and we're still a way off the hawthorn being in flower, but there are a lot of trees that are in flower, so the bees will be getting onto those. Just thinking about your specific situation with the field that's not yet in flower, it might be worth, you might already be doing this and we've not discussed it, but it might be worth getting some pollen substitute onto those nukes and just feeding them up a little bit. If they're relatively small, then they won't have sufficient bees to get out and forage particularly well, which means that pollen will be difficult for them to bring in any quantity. And if you've got some pollen substitute on them, then that might help them in building up over the next couple of weeks, just to the size that they can get out and take advantage of the nectar and pollen from the oilseed rape.
Yeah, they have actually had pollen dub. So almost as an insurance policy, I put fondant on the colonies, probably starting sort of end of January. Now I've had time to look inside those nukes. Actually, what I've realised is there's very, very little in the way of stores in them. And I'm fairly confident that the fondant has kept them going. And I then put pollen sub on. And I've probably done that for maybe 3 weeks or so. Definitely 2 to 3 weeks, I would say. Maybe a month. And what I found, though, throughout all of the colonies, in the last week, they've stopped taking it.
Right.
So the very, very small nukes, I've given them some syrup, one-to-one sugar syrup or invert B syrup. I've got a little bit left over. So I've given them that to try and boost up a little bit.
And have you seen any pollen coming into those nukes?
There's definitely pollen coming into the ones at the home apiary. The ones at one of the out apiaries that's 3 miles away, I can't say that I've seen it. I haven't been there for long enough, to be perfectly honest.
So it might well be that the pollen sub is now being ignored in favour of natural pollens, that they're being able to forage, which is great. That's exactly what they want, really. We talked about putting together some questions just finally before we we conclude. Have you got any questions that you'd like to throw up?
Yeah, there's a couple. Thank you. I noticed obviously that you've gone on to Langstroth hives recently, and when you look at the Langstroth hives that are available, there's the Anel one, and there's ones that I've forgotten the name of the other one, but there's the Anel hive, and they look such good value compared to cedar, to be perfectly honest. You know what I'm probably too deep into it now, really, to get rid of my national hives, because I don't know, I've maybe got 40, 45 boxes, maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 boxes. So there's quite a lot of investment there, you know, along with floors and roofs and whatever. But for somebody who's just starting out, I'd be really tempted to go and look at those Langstroth plastic hives. What are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, so I'm a Langstroth convert. So we started, and over the years, we've tried lots of different types of hive, mainly in the latter years, in order to produce videos to show people and to demonstrate to people the different hive types and what they can and can't do. I suspect that an awful lot of beekeepers are using a Buckfast type of queen, which is a fairly prolific colony, builds a large brood nest area, and that for me throws up problems with a standard national. Because what you can end up with is 10 or 11 frames of brood and absolutely no food in that brood box. So you have to be very careful about taking honey off, because if you take the box off the top, you could actually have a starving colony within a week. A Langstroth, and this is the same for 14 by 12 colonies, so 14 by 12 national, and also for commercial beehives, they have a lot more room available to the bees in the brood box. And as a result, you can get food stores within that brood box area sufficient so that when you take your honey supers off, you're not depriving them of all of their food. And I guess over the last few years, we may have had one or two colonies that have been in Langstroth hives where they've filled the entire 10 frames in that bottom box with brood. Generally speaking, there's always been some room for them within there to store food. So that's the first thing to say. And I guess I'm more inclined. So the other hive type that's similar to the Anel is the one that we use, which is the Technoset hive. And that, unfortunately, I don't think is available here in the UK. It's a plastic hive, which has the insulation inside the plastic shell. It's a fantastic system. It all clips together, works really nicely, but it has its very minor negative attributes as well. And so my personal favourite is the Honeypore hive, which is the Holly Langstroth hive that we started with, it might be 4 or 5 years ago now. We were very lucky to collaborate with Paul Beardmore at Modern Beekeeping, who supplied us with some Honeypore Langstroth hives. And honestly, they've been fantastic. And the bees overwinter so well in them. They are just absolutely miles ahead of any of the wooden hives that we've ever used. And when we had the combination of commercials and nationals in wood and these Honeypore Poly Langstroths, the Honeypore Langstroths were always 2 to 3 weeks ahead of the wooden hives. It's an interesting conversation to have. And I know that there are going to be purists out there that demand cedar and want the look and the feel of cedar, and I understand that, and you know, I'm perfectly happy with that, and I'm in no way going to tell people that they have to get rid of their wooden hives in favor of poly hives. In terms of environmental impact, we've been using these poly hives now every single season, and they're still going strong. They're showing no signs of falling apart. They take a bit of hive tool damage. If you catch it with a hive tool, you're going to put a mark in it, but that's the same with cedar. If you catch it, you're going to leave a mark. The only thing I would say is if you forget about it and you leave it full of wax moth, then the wax moth will completely destroy it. And they go through polystyrene hives very, very quickly, whereas wooden hives, they tend not to chew into quite so quickly. So you have perhaps a little bit more time with a wooden hive. Honestly, we probably had 60 plus commercial, national, and 14 by 12 hives, and we got rid of them all in favor of the Langstroth. I find that the size is great. A Langstroth super holds a really decent amount of honey, and I'm set now for the rest of my beekeeping career with Langstroth. And I would recommend to anybody just starting, Langstroth is the way to go. Although National is the UK's favourite beehive, I think more and more people are turning to Langstroth and finding that it gives them what they need in terms of space for that brood nest area. So, yeah, what I'm saying, Nick, is get rid of all your Nationals and buy some Langstroth. From a financial perspective, there's some really good deals out there currently if you are prepared to look away from traditional hives. However, having said that, I love the feel of a cedar hive. I love the smell of a cedar hive. The cedar hives take me back to when I first started beekeeping. And you're right, if I could afford them, then I might have more cedar. But undoubtedly, the honey pour poly hives seem to get the bees through those peaks in temperature, peaks and troughs in temperature, where in the summer it's really, really hot, and in the winter it can be really, really cold. The poly hives seem to even that temperature curve, that differential, so it doesn't get as hot, it doesn't get as cold. And of course, what do we do with our cedar hives but slap a tin roof on top so that the sun can bake them in the summer, and in the winter it can act as a heat sink. And again, I know there'll be people out there listening who will tell me that they use insulation and all that kind of stuff, and that's fine. I'm not trying to persuade anybody away from their cedar hives, but if you talk to Paul Beardmore at Modern Beekeeping, I'm sure he'll do you a very good price on a honey pour hive, and I love them. I think they're fantastic, and you'll see lots more of them this year on the videos because we'll be keeping them at our queen rearing apiary this year, so we'll have a lot more available to do videos with.
There's just one thing that I've never heard you mention about, and I don't know. I think it'll probably only be a couple of minutes for you if you don't mind answering. And that's just in relation to records for your hive. I've never heard you mention about actually keeping a record of what each colony is doing. Now, I kept sort of quite extensive records last year because I didn't really know what I was doing, and I wanted to be able to look back on it so that I could say, right, I did this in August, and it was a piece of paper that was laminated in each hive. But it takes a lot of time, and I just wondered whether, because obviously you're far, 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 far more experienced than I am, I was just wondering whether that's, you could just look at a colony and you know what to do with it, and you don't bother writing it down, or if you have, some people use stones and bricks in certain places. I wonder what you used.
Yeah, so we've started using a diary some years back, but we tend to keep records in terms of the apiary and colonies in that apiary that are in some way throwing up a question for us. So let's say we've got an apiary down the road on my allotment and it's got 10 beehives on it. They're all doing fine, but one of them is really, really large and needs some extra space, and one of them's particularly weak and may need to be united or might be showing signs, let's say, of deformed wing virus. Those are the two colonies that I would write some notes about. I wouldn't write notes about all of them, but what we also do is we scribble notes on the roof using these water-based queen marking pens. So we'll just scribble a note on the top, and it's the same process as using a brick or several stones or whatever method you want to keep records. Ultimately, these records are for you, and you need to be able to use them. I think I kept records fairly consistently for many years, never really had time to go back and review them and look at them. Notes for me are fantastic on a week-by-week basis and a month-by-month basis, but I very rarely go back and review what's happened in individual hives when I sit down in the winter and turn the Christmas tree lights on. We'll scribble some notes in a diary, but that's pretty much it. And I think it is about experience. I know that, and again, there are some very experienced beekeepers who have far more experience than me that keep very thorough notes about everything. And that's just fine. For me personally, I don't feel I want that. And I don't feel I need that. But I do want to keep records to identify any issues that we might have in an apiary. But yeah, I guess that's pretty much it. Nick, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to catch up at some point, but thanks again for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. My apologies to Nick, because that was quite a heavily edited conversation. We did chat for quite an extended period. And perhaps we can catch up again with Nick in the autumn or winter and see how he fared this season. Don't forget to check out my website, www.norfolk-honey.co.uk, and for my latest videos and podcasts with more updates, tips and techniques, it's the same Patreon page, www.patreon.com/Norfolk Honey. And remember, I'm Stuart Spinks, and that was Beekeeping, Short and Sweet.